Well, good afternoon, everybody. I think we're going to get started. We have such an exciting session and group and lineup of expert speakers. I don't want to delay in getting us started. And thank you so much for being here this afternoon in this exciting session, Health Education and the Affordable Care Act, Successes, Challenges, and Stories from the Field. This afternoon, you're going to be not only hearing from experts that are working in different settings, but also we're going to get you very engaged and involved in our sessions. So we have work for you to do. I have to say this is part of the standard kind of APHA language. I have no conflicts to disclose as the moderator for the session. My name is Elaine Auld, and I'm the advocacy chair for the Public Health Education and Health Promotion section, and I am also the CEO of Society for Public Health Education in Washington, D.C. The sort of the genesis for this session came about in May of this year, where we had leadership of this section and the National Commission of Health Education Credentialing and also SOPI come together in Washington, D.C. to really look at what we could do to take the opportunities that are presented by ACA and make sure that health education specialists are integrated in the work that we're doing. And this is our kind of agreement as three organizations wanting to work together to enhance the communication and visibility of our discipline in ACA. We decided as a result of that meeting there was four major areas for collective action that we're continuing to work on today. There's a copy of our four-page brief report that's, I think I had some copies back there on the table, but it's also available on the SOPI website. And we agreed that we need further research to be done in this area, marketing and communication, advocacy and education and training. And really the genesis for this session and the session that some of you were able to attend this morning was really designed to enhance the communication with major stakeholders that we had this morning, such as the American Medical Association, the American Hospital Association, and then really to try to collect more information from you, more qualitative information on the kinds of roles that you are playing in the field, and so that's why we're here today. I wanted to point out the many excellent resources that APHA has on its website are related to health reform and ACA. If you haven't been there lately, they have some great toolkits that can help you in your work. And also wanted to point out a number of SOPI resources that we have around the Affordable Care Act and invite you to go to the website and access those freely, as you do not have to be a member to access these. But also wanted to bring to your attention that we will be having a Health Education Advocacy Summit next fall in Washington, D.C. This will be our 18th year that we put it on, and again, it will provide us some policy advocacy work to leverage our discipline in the whole, not only appropriations and funding, but other kinds of policy issues to elevate our role in health education and the Affordable Care Act. Today we have as our objectives just to be able to explain this strategic framework in advancing the role of the health education specialist in implementing ACA. I think you should be able to walk away with at least three skills that some of our expert presenters are going to talk about how they're using their knowledge and competency in health education in advancing ACA, and then how you might be able to share with us your stories and find out what you're doing that we could then use that qualitative information in discussing this with other stakeholders. So the first part of our session today, you'll hear from our expert presenters on their stories from the field, how they're working in community health departments, how they're working in medical care settings, how they're working in work sites, and also some of the latest research about what are the knowledge and attitudes of health education specialists, such as yourself, about the Affordable Care Act and what might we need to learn further. Then we're going to break up into small groups. As you can see, we're organized around the room, and as health educators, we want to get you involved in helping tell your stories from the field and letting us know what you're doing and what are the other areas that the leadership can help you do in terms of advancing your role. So we're going to spend part two of the session collecting your stories. You should all have a piece of paper in front of you now that gives you some food for thought as you listen to our expert presenters, and we hope you jot down your responses. We're going to be collecting those yellow sheets from you at the end of today's session, And we're actually going to have a drawing for Amazon gift cards of $25 each. So you'll be following up. We'll be following up with the winners after today's session. So a little incentive for you to use the time to jot down your ideas. With that, I'm going to turn it over to our first speaker, Jessica Strong. Jessica is a project manager at Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City, Utah. She has an MPH and she is MCHES certified. She's passionate about the Affordable Care Act, expanding healthcare access, and improving the quality of healthcare. Her work involves improving transitions, connections, and handoffs for patients across the Intermountain Health System. And she's going to be presenting the research that she's done on the health education specialist knowledge, attitudes, and perceptions of ACA. Jessica?
Thanks, Elaine. Happy to be here today. I have no conflict of interest to disclose. Always important to get that out of the way. Just as a really brief overview, I'm assuming most of you know about the Affordable Care Act, that the healthcare costs in our country are astronomical, they're out of control, and the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, is an attempt to legislatively help correct some of those problems. The triple aim is kind of the three main goals of the ACA, which involves improving quality, decreasing the cost of healthcare, as well as increasing access to healthcare. Part of the ACA is there are a lot of prevention provisions. A lot of people may not realize that. Hopefully you in public health recognize those. And there are also components that stipulate an increase in the healthcare workforce. The research questions that I started with when we started this research was, what are the knowledge and attitude of health education specialists regarding the ACA, and how does that compare to the general public? Do health education specialists foresee job growth as a profession under the ACA? And is there any kind of association between their knowledge of the ACA and their favorability of the law? The methodology that we used is we did an online survey and sent that out to CHES and MCHES certified health education specialists. We did a random sampling. Our list started out with 607 invitations. We collected back 343 responses, and then we had to eliminate a few of those, 98 because they were not currently employed in public health. 28 of those surveys were incomplete, so we ended up with an analytical sample of 220. The instrument that we used was a 33 multiple choice and short answer questionnaire. It covered knowledge, attitudes, perceptions, demographic information, as well as questions that we took directly from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Kaiser does a monthly survey of the general public, and they've been doing this for years and years, asking them a whole bunch of different questions, but some of those specifically relate to the ACA. So we took their questions and used them directly so that we can compare general public to the health education specialists. We did a data analysis. We used SAS and looked at frequencies as well as an ANOVA knowledge scale. And the results, which is what everyone's most interested in, is that our respondents were mostly female, they were mostly Caucasian, they were mostly CHES certified rather than MCHES certified. Most of them had a master's degree, and they were politically more liberal leaning than conservative, which may or may not be surprising. I think public health is a generally more liberal profession. So here's some of the qualitative questions. We asked the health education specialist to list existing provisions in the law. We said, write down three provisions that are currently happening in the law. And we found on the left bar here, 78% of what they wrote were accurate, which was encouraging. So they had a fair knowledge and grasp of current provisions in the law. 13% of those were partially accurate, and 9% were either totally inaccurate or too vague to be able to code properly. Then we asked them about Title IV, which directly relates to public health. And it's interesting that their accuracy dropped dramatically when we asked them about Title IV. Only 35% of the responses were accurate, 57% were partially accurate, and most of those fell into the category of they named something that was a part of the law but not part of Title IV, or a provision that was to be implemented later, something like that. And you can also see at the top, the responses, just total responses, dropped as well when we asked specifically about the public health preventions. This graph shows the attitudes of health education specialists across four different measures at the bottom. So we asked them how favorable they were of the law, and you can see that over 70% were either somewhat or very favorable of the law. Same thing with familiarity. We asked them how they felt the ACA would be at increasing the number of insured people in America. You can see they also felt that it would be very or somewhat favorable. And then I like to put in this political view because, again, I think that really does have an impact on their view. A lot of these health education specialists were more liberal-leaning. We only had a very small percent that identified as either somewhat or very conservative politically. So this graph is a little confusing, but I couldn't figure out a good way to narrow this down. But this is their perception, health education specialist perception of the law compared to the general public. So for each color, the darker color is the health educator's perception, and then the lighter color is Kaiser, which is basically the general public. And so on the left, for country as a whole, we said, how do you think the country will be better off as a whole under the ACA? Do you think it'll be better off, worse off, or about the same? So you can see on the green, 63% of health education specialists said that they felt the country as a whole would be better off as compared to 34% of the general public. Same thing when you get to quality of health care. The health education specialists believed, 39% believed that the country would be better off as compared to 24% for the general public. And then you get over to the cost, and it's the same thing. The red bars represent the answers who said they believe the country would be worse off. So again, you'll notice that the light red, more of the pink color, is much higher than the darker red. The general public is far less optimistic about this law than health education specialists. This graph represents the knowledge questions that we asked. We gave the survey respondents a list of 12 provisions associated with the law, 8 of which were correct provisions that are actually included in the law, and 4 of which are common myths that are often associated with the law. And we asked them to say, is this actually part of the law or not? Yes, no, or you don't know. And then we compared that where we could mirror those questions directly with Kaiser. We compared to the general public as well. So you can see the top blue box on the left, these are the correct provisions. And so you would expect the answer to be yes, because that's the correct answer. These provisions are associated with the law. And you can see that for most of them, the health education specialists were pretty accurate. They knew a fair amount. Most of the time they knew more than the general public, although not always. But there are a couple that stand out. If you look at this one here, increase upper income payroll tax, that is correct. That is a provision in the law. But you can see that the general public were actually more familiar with that provision than the health education specialists. And then when you get down to increase the healthcare workforce, only 30% of the HESs knew that that was a correct provision in the law. Then when we move over here to the common myths, so over in this blue section, the answer should be no. Because these are not truly associated with the law. Death panels, it's a great big common myth out there. You can see that, again, the health education specialists were more knowledgeable about the general public, but you can also see that these numbers are quite a bit lower. They're less confident when it comes to these myths. So these myths are still persistent in the public health population as well as in the general populace. We also asked them about their job prospects, if they thought that job opportunities for health education specialists would increase under the law, as well as in what sectors they believe that would occur. So it's interesting, they did definitely feel like in hospital and healthcare they saw or foresaw a big increase in jobs and possibilities there. State government, local health departments, they do see increases in these. I think it's kind of interesting that business was a little bit lower, and in fact, that was a big one where they predicted no change at all, because there are quite a few provisions in the law that talk about wellness, and worksite wellness is a big part, that's a big area that's growing, and I personally think that that's a potential opportunity for our health education specialists. So So this was the ANOVA that we correlated their knowledge of the law with some of these other views. And it, just as a reminder, there were 12 provisions, 8 which were true, 4 which were myths. And we correlated their knowledge, so how well they did on the knowledge of those 12 items, with some of their other views. And it's interesting that on the favorability of the ACA, when we asked them how favorably they viewed the law, there was a statistically significant correlation between those who have a favorable view of the law and those who scored well on the knowledge scale. Same thing with familiarity of the law, which, you know, is kind of a no-brainer. If you're more familiar with the law, we would expect that their knowledge would be higher. But there was also a correlation between if they believed the country as a whole would be better off, if they thought that increasing the uninsured population would be successful, as well as if healthcare costs would be better. Those were all statistically correlated with having a better knowledge score. So what I take from this research is that more education is needed among our public health peers. We need better education about what the law is, what it's not, as well as potential opportunities, and especially in those areas that directly relate to public health. It's interesting that, again, Title IV, which specifically addresses public health issues, a lot of people weren't familiar with that. So I think we need more education. We need to be able to disseminate that information further and wider. I think forums like this is a great opportunity and a great way to do that. Increased advocacy, so we can, you know, continue to advocate for funds. I'm sure many of you may know the public health fund has been viewed as legislators as kind of a slush fund. And so despite the fact that there's been money allocated to public health programs, it's already been cut frequently because legislators don't view that as a high priority. So I think more advocacy there is needed, as well as further research. I believe this was a great first start and a first step to research and see what the public health opinion is of the law. There's been lots of studies on physicians and med students and, you know, those more clinical professions, but not a whole lot on the correlation and the attitudes of public health professionals. So I would hope that there'd be more research out there as well that could stem from this. Question?
What year was the public survey and the health education
survey? It was done in 2013. It was the fall of 2013. And actually, that brings up a great point. One of our limitations was that we were conducting the survey at the exact same time that healthcare.gov launched. And if you all remember that catastrophe, so there's a potential historical bias there. But yes, it was 2013, so before the full implementation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jessica. Jessica also has her research published in Health Promotion Practice, so if you'd like to check that out. I think it's in the DOI right now, right? It's online first for Sophie's Journal, Health Promotion Practice. So congratulations to you for that. Our next speaker is going to be Michael Stoffaker. Michael's been the Director of Health Management and Central HR Administration at Emory University in Atlanta since 2012. In this role, he develops, implements, and evaluates health management programs and services for the university and healthcare employees, some 29,000. From 94 to 2012, Michael worked for Staywell Health Management. Some of you might be familiar with that health management vendor for Fortune 100 employees. And prior to that, he was the health education director for the American Lung Association of Kentucky for 8 years. And so Michael's going to be talking about that opportunity in the worksite setting that we have as health education specialists. Michael?
Thank you, Elaine. Thank you, everybody, for joining us this afternoon. Other than Emory pays my paycheck, I have no disclosures, no relationships to disclose. A little bit about Emory. Some of you may be familiar with Emory. It is an academic medical center located in Atlanta, Georgia. And if you think about it as a work site, there are two divisions. You have higher ed and you have the health system. And so this is a very specific work site setting, and what I'm going to share with you is probably akin to other health educators who work in academic medical centers, but maybe not very similar to health educators who work in Fortune 1000 private companies. A little bit about Emory University. We have about 15,000 students. About half of our students are graduate or professional level students, and about 20% are international students. Emory Healthcare is the largest healthcare system in the state of Georgia. You may be familiar with Emory University Hospital. We treated the first Ebola patient successfully in the United States. My position as Director of Health Management is within the university part of the organization. I have a direct reporting responsibility into the VP of Human Resources, who reports into our Executive Vice President of Finance and Administration. And like other large complex organizations, it's a very matrixed organization. I have a dotted line reporting relationship to the Chief HR Officer at Emory Healthcare. So a little bit about my role in the ACA implementation. I pulled these four bullet points out of my job description, and I have highlighted two of the things that are most appropriate to our conversation today. Part of my responsibility is to work with the healthcare system, including the ACO, the Emory Healthcare Network, or the Accountable Care Organization that was mentioned briefly on the first slide. Emory Healthcare established the ACO on 1/1/15, and so we're relatively new as an organization providing an accountable care organization services. I also am staffed to our health plan steering committee, and as a health educator, this was quite new to me, learning the vocabulary of health plan design, how rates are set, what one takes into account in managing a health plan. In working with our ACO, the Emory Healthcare Network, we used a benefits consulting firm to negotiate the terms of agreement. And part of that, as was mentioned in the presentation earlier, accountable care organizations' two primary focus are to, one, provide better quality care, and also, number two, to provide more cost-effective care. And so for the Accountable Care Act and the ACO that Emory Healthcare offers, we use the HEDIS quality metrics that have been around for about 20 years or so and are the major measurements as part of the NCQA offering of accreditation. A few examples of these quality metrics are what is our rate of breast cancer screening? What is the rate of folks with diabetes who get a retinal eye exam? What is the rate of our folks, our health plan members who have their hemoglobin A1C measured? For those members who have asthma, what is the use of appropriate medications? And so these are the metrics that the health plan follows in terms of quality. There are a number of others that we use at Emory. I have also been involved in the Strategic Oversight Committee. So Aetna, one of the big health plans, is the third-party administrator, TPA, one of the many acronyms I had to learn as a health educator. And so the Emory Healthcare Network, in conjunction with Aetna, is guiding the implementation of the accountable care of the ACO at Emory. And then I am also seated at the Clinical Care Collaboration Committee, which reviews the quality metrics actually on a monthly basis. So we keep an eye on how the quality is doing for our members. As I thought about the health education knowledge and skills needed over the past 3 years with Emory Healthcare, the ACO, and the health plan, these are some of the skills that come from NCHEC, from the documents that we all know and love over the last few years. But it's quite a broad listing of knowledge and skills. I would say some of the things that were stretched for me in terms of my role as a health educator, and for those of you who are thinking about the Accountable Care Organization and ACA in general, knowing more about finance, how cost trends are calculated, being familiar with NCQA and the various HEDIS measures, and then something that was brand new to me was something called attribution. When you are in a ACO, it's very important that you match patients with providers in a very accurate way, and I think one of my colleagues later on will touch on that. I would say that attribution models vary. There isn't a gold standard. There are a number of ways that you can attribute a patient. One of the key ways is making sure that you have a primary care provider attached to each of the patient. One would think that that's a relatively easy thing to do. It's not. I would say in the two-year process for establishing the ACO, it took us probably 14 months for Emory, the employer, Emory, the health plan, Emory Healthcare, the provider, Aetna, and Emory Healthcare Network, the ACO, to agree to which attribution model to use, and then as that attribution model was implemented, which were the correct results. And so I think that's a key learning for any of you thinking about or involved with accountable care organizations, is the length of time it takes to get the correct data sets and align them correctly and appropriately so all stakeholders are satisfied, I would say. Some of the major challenges are rather general. The healthcare system is changing by fits and starts. The accountable care organization model is intended to improve quality and reduce costs. We'll see. It has its heart in the right place. CMS and other organizations are moving reimbursement models to at-risk models where healthcare organizations aren't paid for the number of services, but how well you keep a population healthy. And as with anything, coordination of all the players gets quite complex. There are certain stakeholders and turf issues that need to be attended to in this process. A couple of things that, as I reflected on my past 3 years and as a health educator, it took me a little while to understand that when my medical and clinical colleagues were talking about population health management, they meant something different than what I thought population health management was as a health educator. Our clinical colleagues, at least initially, think about population health management in the early years of the ACO and focusing on those very, very high cost patients, members, and employees. Recommendations for strengthening our profession's visibility in the ACA. As part of the ACO structure, many accountable care organizations have care coordinators. They go by a variety of names. Typically, they are nurses doing clinical outreach, but also health education outreach. And this is an opportunity that I see from the employer perspective to work together to leverage both health education strengths, but also our clinical colleague strengths.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Michael, for sharing your worksite health story from the field. Gives us a lot of food for thought, and in our opportunity later on, for those of you that are in other worksite settings, we'll have a chance to add to your story and what some of the challenges you see in your current work. You should have also gotten an index card when you walked in, and that's for you to be able to write down questions for our lightning round. We're going to try to keep all the questions to the end so we get all the perspectives here, all the stories, and then we'll have a quick time with the Q&A with each of the individual speakers. So be writing down your thoughts. Our next speaker is Nancy Clifton Hawkins. Nancy is the manager of the community benefits at the City of Hope. She has over 20 years' experience in developing, implementing, and evaluating population health or public health programs in vulnerable communities. Her current role requires her to weave the complex relationships within the City of Hope and the vulnerable communities within the service area that she works. Nancy's also the board treasurer for the National Commission for Health Education Credentialing, and she's a master certified health education specialist and actively participates as a member of the Health Consortium of San Gabriel Valley, which is a consortium of local health care and mental health providers of safety net services. She's going to be talking about her experiences as being involved in the community benefit aspect in a healthcare setting. Nancy, welcome.
Good morning, everybody. I'm so glad to share part of my day with all of you. So, like everybody else, I have nothing to disclose. First, I wanted to give you an overview of what City of Hope is. City of Hope is a cancer institute. It's located in Duarte, so the San Gabriel Valley. It is an institution that does research as well as preventing cancer. We also dive into things for the prevention of diabetes, also HIV/AIDS, and our mission is to transform the future of health by turning science into practical benefit and hope into reality. And I heard just a couple weeks ago that they're on an edge to find a cure for hemophilia there too. Hot off the press. City of Hope is a research hospital. It's fairly big, 7 floors, but small in bed space. Every patient has a private room. Each floor is designated to the different type of cancer that a patient has. So the bone marrow transplant patients are on one floor, and pediatrics are on another floor. Solid tumors are on yet another. We have ICU and an emergency treatment center there. We have an ambulatory care center. Interestingly enough, people could come in the morning and get a bone marrow transplant and go home in the evenings for less severe types of cases. There are 89 rooms there for people to go in and get their services. So it's an interesting institution, and my role actually at City of Hope just started a year ago. We didn't have a Department of Community Benefits until I got there. I was actually hired, for means of history, as a senior health education specialist, and just a small portion of what I did was around community benefit, and I realized that we weren't doing a good enough job at it, and so we were actually able to sell the hospital's investment and obligation to invest in a Department of Community Benefits, which I was lucky enough to be able to take the lead on. You were looking at the department. I booked my own flights, hotel rooms, make my own photocopies. The neat part about what I get to do at City of Hope, a lot of other people don't get to do in a lot of other places. I mean, City of Hope is a major research institute. We actually have a graduate school that provides PhDs. We have large fellowships and population sciences departments that are all navigated a lot of times by our cancer grants. So they have NCI grants and requirements to do health equity issues. And then we have the medical center. Community benefits falls within the medical center side. the part that's interesting about that is the Research Institute with the cancer grant has to do health equity, which is a lot like community benefits. So what I get to do is I get to navigate those roads and kind of prevent duplication of services. I move from the clinical side in the hospital. I get to work with the finance individuals. I work with human resources, marketing and communication, government and community relations, patient family, community education, anybody inside and out to get them to understand that what they do inside the hospital actually has an impact on the vulnerable populations around there. So what do we have to do and what is community benefit and what does it have to do with the Affordable Care Act? How many of you here in the audience are familiar with community benefits and nonprofit hospitals? Wow, look at that. So I'm going to preach to the choir. Okay, that's cool. If I miss anything, let me know. So part of the Affordable Care Act came up and said, hey, all of you nonprofit hospitals, you have to do a triennial community health needs assessment. What that meant was a lot of hospitals, I mean, we've been doing community benefits for a long time, and a lot of hospitals said, well, we're going to put our tax savings as a nonprofit over into where we want to do, you know, special pet projects and things like that. They were not targeted towards specific needs of the vulnerable community. So the Affordable Care Act finally put into law, hey, you guys, sure, you're doing some fun things, but we think it's really important for you to target your needs to the vulnerable community. So there goes the triangle needs assessment. Then we have to take that, because before the Affordable Care Act, they would do their needs assessments, and then they'd sit in a drawer somewhere and not do anything with them. And so they said, hey, you ought to write an implementation strategy so you can show us what it is that you said you're going to do, right? So now there's another document that holds the nonprofit hospitals accountable for doing what it is that they said they would do, and also recognize that they took the time to assess the needs of the vulnerable community. And then, I mean, all of us who are health educators know this is a no-brainer, right? Then we have to report on it every year. And we have to say if we didn't reach something, why we didn't reach it. And that's scary for some hospitals. But for all of us, it's important because transparency is huge. The other thing that I get to do is I get to collaborate with internal stakeholders. So what I've done is it's about institutionalizing community benefits within our hospital, making all those clinicians, you know, think outside of the clinical framework and say, hey, these people don't come to City of Hope just as cancer patients. You know, they have families, they live in communities, they travel from great distances to come there to get their care. When they leave us, they go back into those communities. So my job is to really get people to understand what they're doing. So far they're starting to get it, right? The next step is getting them to evaluate what they're doing and getting them to understand that a satisfaction survey isn't the same thing as an evaluation survey to determine the impact of why you spent your time, energy, and money, right, on doing those sort of things to begin with. So it's really getting in there and trying to figure out how I can get them to buy into it and understand the importance of it, and I'm in the middle of that right now. So the other thing that I get to do to get community benefits to work at City of Hope is I get to work with my external community. A big part of this is to ensure the fact that the hospital executives didn't get together and say, we want these points, and these points from the implementation strategy to focus on over the next 3 years. That's great, but it doesn't really represent the issues that are important to the people in the community that we're serving. I mean, why did we survey them and do an assessment to begin with, right? So we have a Community Benefit Advisory Council. Susan Wright here is one of my members on that council. What they do is they help us to ensure transparency. I actually train our community members who actually have expertise in the areas of the vulnerable community. So they may be public health, they could be someone from the school district, a non-English speaking mom who does PTA, which we're working on getting, right? We've got Planned Parenthood, the Komen Foundation, I've got competitor hospitals, because in community benefits, when you meet the needs of the vulnerable population, there's no competition there. We could leverage and share resources and make things happen. Anyway, the idea is I've trained them on how to do this, and then our community groups come in, or our internal groups talk about the program that they have, and they also get to say, well, that's not really a community benefit, it doesn't meet, you know, the five core principles, and then it'll shock people, and then they'll be able to say, oh, well, this is what you can do to make your program better. In addition to that, we have a grant program that we fund in the community that our community benefit community benefit advisory members helped us create, and they actually selected the recipients of it this past year. And so now we've invested in 7 nonprofit organizations who do things around healthy living, obesity prevention or reduction, and physical fitness, which aren't things that City of Hope does, although, I mean, ironically, we do share risk factors for a lot of those different things. So the group funded them, and then I go in and provide technical assistance and monitoring and evaluation and creating a sense of community around our grantees, which is really fun. So the things that we have to do in order to be in my position, really, I get to work at the top of my class every single day. All of those 7 areas of responsibility that we have as health educators, CHES or MCHES, assessing needs, right? Monitoring, evaluating, designing training curriculum, assessing whether or not someone gets the concepts that you're trying to use. I get to use all of those different things. And I'm jumping into policy, working with government community relations so we can link the research that we're doing at our institute directly with policymakers so we can make an impact on the built environment around physical activity and obesity and all those other things. Things that we can do to enhance the job. If you're in my job, it would be important for you to be able to work across disciplines. We can't just be in a silo anymore. It's important for you to be open and understand that you don't just work with the doctors in order to make things work. You need to get everybody who's a part of the healthcare team internally and externally. You have to have effective collaboration skills. There's really not a lot of room for your ego to be involved in this. You have to be open and share ideas across, you know, the things that are going on. I have been in the field for 20 years, so I've gained a lot of experience. And so, you know, I've eaten a lot of humble pie. I've learned how to work with lots of different people, but those are things that you need to bring into this type of position. Most importantly, you have to be confident. In my role, I am responsible for our federal requirement. We could lose our nonprofit status like Blue Cross Blue Shield did because they hoarded all their community benefit dollars and didn't spend it on the vulnerable community, right? Our hospital could lose it. That's millions and millions and millions of dollars that we could have. So I have to be confident that I'm upholding something important for the institution, but also have a passion for service. I'm not just serving my internal stakeholders, I'm serving the vulnerable community as well. So it's a really great place to be a health educator. Major challenges are just here, you know, the same thing, policy, regulatory environments, getting people to understand what's going on, building sustainable systems so that maybe I'm not there anymore, but someone could continue to carry on my work. Institutional policy measures that have to be put in place so that the institution adopts what we're doing and puts it into job descriptions so that the staff are required to fulfill the reporting duties every single year and then just evaluate, and make things better. So I don't have any other recommendations other just to let all of you know that every single nonprofit hospital across this country is required to put their community benefit reports on their websites in a place where you can find them, okay? The community benefit website, if you go to the bottom, you'll see community benefits in plain English. Click on that. You can find my reports. Most other hospitals, you won't be able to find them. It might be under community health improvement or something else. You can also get all of our tax documents off GuideStar and check and see where we've been spending our money. But that's it. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Nancy. It's pretty amazing what a one-woman shop can do. Pretty awesome. We're also going to hear from another speaker this afternoon that's working in a healthcare environment with a primary focus on community health needs assessment. So our next speaker is going to be Dr. Ricky Brar. She's Associate Director for the Center for Urban Health at Thomas Jefferson University Hospitals and is also an assistant professor at Thomas Jefferson University and the Sidney Kimmel Medical College. She has over 40 years of experience ranging from teaching health education in public and private school to corporate wellness programs, hospital community outreach programs, and academic medical school and public health programs. Welcome, Ricky.
So the good news is I get to go near the end, and the bad news is I get to go near the end, right? Because so much has already been talked about, but I will try not to be too repetitive. Like everyone else, I have no relationships to disclose. So healthcare is really changing very quickly. The organization that I work for has had huge changes in the past few years. I work for Thomas Jefferson University Hospital. That's who employs me. I also teach in the university. And Jefferson is a healthcare university of our new mission statement. Everything is new, so we're no longer colleges. We're no longer schools. We're all colleges. So all the terminology is. So if I get a little messed up, you'll understand. They just renamed our medical school. So things change really quickly. We are an academic health center in Philadelphia. I'm literally blocks within the Liberty Bell. And we just had the Pope come visit. So you can just imagine what my September was like. Okay. 5 hospitals. 2 are actually in the suburbs. 3 sit within probably a mile of each other. 1 is a community hospital. 1 is Jefferson, which sits right in Center City. And the 3rd is neurosciences. We also have a very strong relationship with Wells Eye, who uses our emergency department. So quaternary medical center. But we do everything from patient care, heavy research, as well as educating health professions. That's all Jefferson does. Our new motto is health is all we do. So it is a university, but again, only in terms of educating healthcare professionals. My job as the Associate Director of the Center for Urban Health is to do much of what Nancy just talked about, community outreach. Although over the past couple of years, it has changed dramatically. I am also the co-director of the college within the college, which is now part of the Sidney Kimmel Medical College. And that program is really, medical students take a course above and beyond their medical school curriculum because they want to. And that course is how you integrate population health, public health into medical school curriculum. So they learn about community resources. They learn about how to do program planning and evaluation. They learn about how, you know, theory, public health theory, and how we use it in counseling. I'm also assistant professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine and in the College of Population Health. I teach in the MPH program. So last but not least, I spend most of my time outside the hospital working in community. So my role in ACA implementation, I now feel like I have 2 jobs, but I also have job security. So that's also really nice, okay? So my job is to conduct one of them, the community health needs assessment for the hospital, and to develop the community health improvement plan with our community partners, as well as our internal partners. One of the things I have learned as I've done this is Jefferson is absolutely huge, and the left hand and the right hand often don't know what they're doing, so there's a lot of opportunity for coordinating around our population health efforts. So I work with a lot of community-based organizations, and that includes the City Health Department. That includes the different departments in the mayor's office now, things like the planning department and the Department on Multiculturalism, places where I didn't spend a lot of time, the streets department. Spend a lot of time with the streets department. So food access, behavioral health organizations, I work with housing, Row House Initiative, Healthy Row House Initiative, that's architects and city planners and public health people. So it's very different than it used to be, much more cross-siloed. As I said before, I train medical students and MPH students, and I'm currently creating a community health worker certification program at Jefferson that's a tiered approach, where the idea of workforce development, where somebody from the community can come in, start at one level, and work their way up through multiple levels, and it's part-time to really focus on the idea that many of our vulnerable community members cannot go to school full-time. They need to work. So we're working on that, as well as Pennsylvania is now working towards a community health worker program across the state. What should that look like? So I'm part of that. And then finally, I got put into this role of big data. And somebody came and asked me from the Delaware Valley Health Information System. They're looking at, they wanted to understand how people who work in population health and public health use big data. What data sources are out there? And the idea being is, how do we connect the electronic medical records to population health? So they're really looking at what are those kinds of things we're really interested in. So just in time, you know, real, not self-report data, real data that comes straight out of the EMR, right? They're looking at how does that inform our efforts at a population health level. So kind of was a subject I knew almost nothing about, what's interoperability. There's a whole like statement that's hundreds of pages long on how to create interoperability, mm-hmm. right? So things that I didn't expect to find myself involved in, as well as how to get people enrolled in the exchange. Biggest accomplishments are things like our community health needs assessment now informs the hospital strategic plan. So it's built right into that. I get to go to all those senior level quarterly report out meetings and try and explain what it is we do and put it into a format that people who do clinical care understand. And it's like putting round pegs into square holes. It's very difficult, but one of the things I think we need to learn is how to talk that talk. And I also, I think that integrating population health into the medical school curriculum and into the community health needs assessment plan has been also put into both. So our students are actually told, if you want money, you need to link it to the community health needs assessment, and we need to organize you in ways that make sense so we can measure our effectiveness. So it's really become a cross-institutional effort. So what knowledge and skills? Everything everybody else talked about. Communication skills, how do you communicate data to all different audiences in ways that make sense for that specific audience? Program planning and evaluation skills. Fortunately, that's what I teach, but I'm learning even more as I go about this. Community engagement in community building. You know, how do you engage the community? How do you keep people at the table long enough to make it happen? Everything is collective impact in Philly, and I think that's probably the same across the country. Policy and systems change. How do we advocate for changes? So I get to do all this as part of my job. I go to all kinds of different... That's it? Okay, faster. Okay, new skill development. How do we make a business case? That's the big one. Return on investment, community, you know, cost effectiveness. How do we fit it into things like bundled payments? How do we make bundled payments pay for our programs? How do we take money that the hospital saves in the ED and put that towards prevention? And the expectation is that will happen. I don't guarantee that that's really going to happen, but I think it's something we need to advocate for. I think most of these have been talked about. I'm trying to see if there's anything that hasn't. Educating. I think one of the big things is we need to talk more about what it is we do and how we differentiate it from other professions. You know, people want to train MAs as health educators and have them do health education jobs. Is that appropriate, not appropriate? What do we bring that other health professions do not bring? And I think we need to be very clear about that. And again, turf battles. In Philadelphia, the hospitals do not play nice in the sandbox for the most part. And we are working very hard with HHS and our Hospital Association of Pennsylvania to ensure that that's going to happen going forward. Recommendations, learn how to speak the language of other disciplines, because that's one thing I've really had to learn to do is how do city planners, what language do they use? I think we're talking about the same thing, but I really need to understand it from their point of view. And again, making this the business case for social determinants of health. And somebody from the CDC in the last one I was at just announced there's a new website that's going to help us all do that. It's going to put a cost to social determinants of health and help us make that case as to why we should be focusing on it. And recommendations, I think the big one that you haven't heard mostly is really understanding what we bring. What are our specific skills and how does that inform the ACA? And how do we talk to people about that in ways that they understand? Our case managers are now coming to me because they want to understand how they link to community resources and what community resources are out there. And I think that's something that as health educators, we really understand how to leverage.
Thank you. So we went from the West Coast to the East Coast with Ricky and talking about what it's like to be in a large medical system. Our last speaker, not least, will be talking to us about her role in a public health department in implementing ACA. That Sherry Lee Sherry is the principal planner for the Minnesota Department of Health, where she's had over 30 years of experience in program development and leadership in community health and health care. She's currently working on the clinical community health strategy of the Minnesota Department of Health state innovation model. And she formerly worked on the community transformation grants.
So we look forward to hearing from Cherilee.
I wore heels today. I haven't worn heels in a long time. Now I'm taller. Welcome, and I'm glad everybody's sticking around, so we'll go kind of quick so we can get up and move. My little thing here has got red lines on it saying I was sitting too long, so we'll go fast. Okay, so I have no relationships to disclose. So I work for the Minnesota Department of Health. This is just a little description about it. I started in 2009, so prior to that I worked in Hennepin County Medical Center, so it's a health system for a safety net health system, I guess. And then prior to that I was the executive director of a community clinic for quite a few years, and then you could go on and on and on back. But what was interesting for me was this was my first government job working for the state. I was always on the outside and then complaining, well, you need to do this, you need to do that. And now I'm on the inside, I'm like, oh, okay, now I know what they mean when they say things, unfortunately. But guess what? I got a troublemaker thing here. So that's actually what I kind of do at the health department as well. Don't tell anybody. I know it's recorded. So when I started at the health department, I started with our health reform initiatives. And one of the things that I learned to do is I knew a lot of different people from my prior work, so I was able to cross the line and move across silos. And I've listed the ones here that I work with. I'm housed in our Office of Statewide Health Improvement Initiatives. But I also, part of my salary is paid off of a CDC grant. It was Community Transformation Grant. Now it's what we call 1422, or the Community Wellness Grant. That's in our Heart Disease and Stroke Unit. And then I also work a lot with our health policy folks. So when I started at the Minnesota Department of Health, I worked in healthcare homes. So Minnesota decided to do healthcare homes, our own patient-centered medical home certification, instead of using NCQA. We did a really in-depth look at what NCQA was requiring, and we felt that it wasn't patient-centered enough. It was patient-centered in the electronic health record, maybe, but not some of the other things that we were looking at. So we did our own. So I worked on getting that all set up. I work with our Office of Rural Health and Primary Care, especially with emerging professions. We have community paramedics. We have community health workers. We have dental therapists, and they all get reimbursement. I also work with our Office of Health Information Technology, talking about big data, talking about electronic health records, all of those kinds of things. And I work with our health economics program as well. So health reform in Minnesota, just really quickly, I know many other states had their own health reform initiatives before the Affordable Care Act. So we in Minnesota were already working toward some of the things, and we were just waiting for the federal government to catch up with us. So we have prevention and public health, and so we follow the triple aim: population health, experience of care, and cost of care, improving it. And so this, our action with this is our statewide health improvement program. That's half of my time. And that program, we look at policy systems and environment change in four settings. And so it's worksite, healthcare, community, and schools. And we focus on behavioral health, where we can make a difference, and that's obesity and tobacco use. But the legislature now is adding in some other things, like just recently they passed that we need to focus on dementia now, preventing dementia. So stay tuned. We'll tell you how that goes. We had our care redesign. So this is our patient experience of care. That's the healthcare homes and quality incentive payments that we have along with that, so that there is care coordination. I was sitting at the table when we were writing the rules, and they were talking about social workers and dietitians as part of the team-based care. And I'm like, well, what about health educators? And there was silence. like nobody knew. But nobody said no. I was typing, okay, we'll add that in there too. And so at least we've got it mentioned. And so wherever I can, I try to mention things. And then transparency. We have our statewide quality reporting measurement system. I know they talked about data and HEDIS measures and all of these kinds of things. And so we worked hard to take a look at those measures, and to we have an organization in Minnesota called Minnesota Community Measurement, where all the clinics submit their data to that organization, and then it's publicly reported. And it's MN, so MinnesotaHealthScores.org, and so you can see any clinic on of how they've progressed on any of the measures that we've got. And then we also have supports of HIT, health information technology, and then administrative simplification. So imagine that in the government, but that's one of our charges. So I talked about with SHIP that we were looking at obesity and tobacco use. So you can see here we started in 1995, we went up to 2013. The blue is the U.S., and then the other color is Minnesota. So we've been able to hold it as opposed to going up. We can't say that it's all SHIP, but we can say that SHIP contributed to it. I don't have the 2014 here. There was a little blip going up, and we're doing a deeper dive into looking at it because we have a large immigrant population. So we have the largest Somali population in the United States, and we have large Hmong, Latino, Russian, Karen, lots of different groups. And so we're taking a look at which ones, and we're seeing that it's not necessarily the Caucasian population, but it might be one of our other populations. And then when we talk about health equity, well, what are some things that we can do about it? So stay tuned. We'll talk more about that. This is as an example. So we did have some data with our tobacco use. I'm pulling it out, stratifying it to look at different races and ethnicity, and looking at the social determinants of health to see where it lands, so that when our grantees work on different projects, maybe that there's maybe it's mental health and tobacco, maybe it's some other the American Indian other groups that we really need to put more effort, time and effort into it instead of our usual suspects. So with the statewide health improvement program, I have the opportunity. I focus on clinical community linkages, and so I get to talk to a lot of people, and so this is just a sample of just so you can see Minnesota, but where some of our CHES folks are working in regards to working on SHIP work. So if we start with Lisa over here. She's working on reaching out and helping people to enroll in the exchanges. And she now supervises a couple of CHWs at a federally qualified healthcare center. Christy is, she works at a health system for family practice residency programs, and she does all the data and quality improvement. We talked a little bit about, well, how do you get that quality out? How do you look at your data, and then how do you move forward and to actually do something about it? And then at last, I'll say Shirley works on our state innovation model grant, and she really works closely with learning communities, Learning Collaborative, and now she's just moved into our e-health. So all of these people have these different, we're in different areas on working on health reform activities, and I think it's just been great that I've been able to find, there's a lot more out there, but been able to find out about them. And this is just an example. I mentioned I was in our healthcare homes, and what we did is we looked at, or I took a look right before I left healthcare homes, this is what we call our foundation. And we received a state innovation model grant where we're working on accountable communities for health, et cetera. But really linking the competencies for CHES on how it can support the different building blocks for this. One of the ones that I don't have, and we kind of mentioned it, is the shared risk benefit. So that's what was talked about before, about patient attribution, about payment models, about risk sharing, all of those kinds of things, because we don't really have that. And there's not many health educators that I've seen in that. Okay, so major challenges, just real quick. I just think that the role and the skills of a health education specialist, people just don't know what we do and what we're capable of doing. And I think it's us just keeping getting the message. I sound like a broken record at work. They talk about something, well, what about health educators? So now they roll their eyes, and now they just add it in because they know if I'm at a meeting, I'm going to say it no matter what, and they've heard it 100 times. One of the nice things that just recently happened, and we have our application into CMS, is that I was sitting at a meeting, and they were talking about behavioral health homes, and they were talking about their team, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, look at this. This is almost all our competencies of people that they were looking for. So then I made sure I went up and talked to the people, and long story short, we got it added, CHES folks, into the bundle of the, well, it's not exactly the bundle, but it's the approved team member that can work within a behavioral health home. So let's just hope CMS passes it and we're good. Allowing health education specialists to be part of a healthcare team. So part of that extension is really important. And how, you know, when we talk about language, that we know the language, and then educating decision makers about prevention in order to keep. So that's that whole advocacy piece. And recommendations. Articulate your value add. You know, health places talk about value add. Communities talk about value add. What's our value add? Advocate for collaborative approaches. And then the strong skill set that we've got. We are good with health literacy, the community health needs assessment, improvement plans, those kinds of things. Again, we need to articulate that. And if we don't know something, then we need to work on just continuing to improve our skills. I became a practice facilitator because even though I knew all that, I worked in clinics, I'm not a nurse. And I'm not a doctor. And so there was just, for them to say, okay, well, yeah, you know, you do know what you're saying. I went through that training just to get it, to say that I have it. Okay, and that's all I have.
Thank you, Shirley. All right. Do we have any quick lightning round questions? Because otherwise we're going to go to, you can see around the room, we have the various settings set up, and you'll be able to interact with the speakers, and there'll be a scribe there to help get your story down from the field. I think all of the examples today are illustrative of the roles that and the skills that we have, but we have to tell the stories. We have to educate the providers. We have to educate other stakeholders. And we have to get the message out about the various skills that health educators bring to the table. Just a few of the things I saw in all of the presentations today are the importance of cost trends and return on investment, being able to talk that language, being able to do evaluations, and the importance of data in our work and how that relates to quality improvement, which is so important. The cross-professional collaboration that we bring, and we have to emphasize that skill in terms of facilitation. And then public accountability, and I think those are all areas that health educators have skills that are directly relevant to those four areas, and some challenges for us to continue to build on those skills for the future. So with that, I would hope that you'll all go to your four areas and maybe hold that question to if the one particular person that you you want to seek out an answer to. Is that okay? And go into that group. And please do share your stories. That's something we heard this morning from the major stakeholders, AMA and CMS, is that they said, we're not getting these stories out enough. It's not in the literature. We need examples of the way that you're improving the community's health or patient and community health, and to get that documented. So please help us do that. We're here to help you do that. Thank you for your attention. And please, we have scribes and facilitators for each of the areas. So please move to one of the six areas around the room. Healthcare,
We just didn't know how many people would be in the healthcare arena, so if there's a large number, we want to give you all a chance to speak. So if there are a number of people in healthcare one already, just go to healthcare two, just to break up the opportunity to be involved. Volunteer, a community, you know, the voluntary health organization or a community health department, the work site, healthcare, again, healthcare two up here, and other. If you don't find yourself fitting into any of those categories, we want to hear about that too, because we want to hear what other areas are you working to implement ACA. And government. Sorry.